This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. Eight-man football teams are becoming more common in Illinois to save the sport in small schools and all that goes with it.
You maintain homecoming, you maintain, you know, all the things that happen within a school in the start of the school year in the fall, I think are important to schools.
The Illinois High School Association Executive Director Craig Anderson says eight-man football in Illinois only began 2 years ago. Plus, ISU basketball great Jackie McCormick shares her post-college story and the road that led her to a tribal court in Washington State. And Normal Town Council member Stan Nord is ruffling feathers. We'll have a report. All that and a GLT News update on the way. This is Sound Ideas on GLT.
Support for the Sound Ideas podcast comes from GLT listeners. Join the community of news consumers who listen to Sound Ideas and are also willing to support it financially. Learn more about listener-supported radio and GLT at WGLT.org.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. Normal Town Council member Stan Nord is ruffling feathers over a meeting with Bloomington's fire chief and a business contact. According to a letter obtained by WGLT, Nord met with Fire Chief Brian Moore and suggested cutting the number of firefighters by 25% and merging the Bloomington and Normal departments. Mayor Chris Koos confirms he wrote the letter to Bloomington's mayor and city manager Tim Gleason. Koos disavows Nord's action.
This situation I'm frustrated with because it's somebody working as a lone wolf, if you will, without input from their fellow council members.
Koos says many questions have to be researched before such a merger can even be discussed. Mayor Terry Renner of Bloomington says it's important that many stakeholders be involved.
There are real problems when just one of them goes rogue and perhaps attempts to negotiate something without talking to others.
Stan Nord says he wanted to hear the other side in the discussion about fire protection on the east side. Nord says he did nothing wrong in having a conversation about public safety.
I knew the Bloomington fire chief from my youth. We showed animals together at the county fair, went to high school together, so this was a personal conversation that got blown up.
Mayor Koos rejects Nord's solo approach.
A proper way to do this would have been to ask for a work session to study this, or doing studies of other communities that may or may not have done this with any success.
Nord says he rejects the notion he should not ask questions about public issues. Koos also criticized Nord in the letter for an apparent attempt to recruit a Bloomington business to the second floor of Uptown One in Normal. He wrote that flies in the face of a mutual agreement with Bloomington not to recruit such relocations across borders. Nord says he did not engage in poaching.
A business did contact me, but it was after they looked at other properties in Normal with their realtor. They asked if I could put them in touch with the appropriate person in Normal they could speak with about a space. After I received that request, I immediately forwarded on to Normal city manager and carbon copied the mayor and council, and later notified the EDC.
The town of Normal engineering planning and inspection staff currently occupies the second floor of Uptown One. Nord declined to say which location the business was interested in, but he also said he hopes the publicity now surrounding the issue does not hurt this real opportunity for the taxpayers of Normal to save a huge amount of money, unquote. Some opponents of the Uptown One project have in the past criticized the amount of rent the town is paying for that space. The town has affirmed in the past the rent is not out of scale for comparable office space elsewhere in the community. Koos says the town has no plans to move those offices. Nord says the mayor is creating a lot of unnecessary rumor and should have just asked him about it. Koos says a lot of people already knew about the meeting with the Bloomington fire chief and the business overture, and to prevent further rumor, he wanted to let Bloomington leaders know the town's official position on those issues. I'm Charlie Schlenker.
G
GLT is a service of Illinois State University. Illinois State is consistently ranked among the top universities nationwide by U.S. News & World Report, which cites Illinois State's academic quality and excellence. More at illinoisstate.edu/pointsofpride. This is 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. Coming up, a civics lesson from Northern Illinois. Illinois has lost one congressional seat every decade going back to the 1950s because of population declines, and given the state's accelerated population loss in recent years, there's concern the state could lose two congressional seats after the next once-a-decade census is complete next year, including one in central or southern Illinois. Anita Banerjee with the nonprofit group Forefront says that's one critical reason why every person has to be counted. She's director of the Democracy Initiative for the Chicago-based group that's funding nonprofits all over the state to meet with populations that have historically been undercounted, including those in Bloomington Normal. Those populations include rents, the disabled, the homeless, seniors, the LGBTQ community, and others. Banerjee tells GLT's Eric Stock, the other key reason for an accurate headcount is to help communities plan.
It would be extremely substantial. When you think about Southern Illinois University having the lowest numbers of attendance and enrollment in decades, I mean, that speaks to the fact that we really need to incentivize. We really need for people to stay in our state after they graduate, to incentivize for students to go to higher ed institutions within our state. We need to be able to provide better resources and access to resources. And we can't do that if we don't have accurate data. If we don't know where people are living, if we don't know where people are going to school, if we don't know where children between the ages of 0 and 5 are, which is the hard-to-count population in the country, it makes it very difficult for us to be proactive and make sound decisions of where we're investing.
So you had referenced those 5 years and younger being the hardest to count. Obviously, they're not the ones doing the counting. Why are they so difficult to be counted, and what are some of the other groups that have been underrepresented in the past?
There is a really great study that came out by the Annie E. Casey Foundation last summer, I want to say, that said that there were about 1 million children that went uncounted in the 2010 census all across the country. And that was astounding. And it was a real wake-up call for people to recognize that when you fill out your census form, it is for every member that is in your household on census day. The millennial generation is considered a hard-to-count population because they are transient, right, in a way that a lot of other communities may not have been traditionally. And their biggest source of information is social media. And we have never used social media for census outreach purposes before in the way that is necessary for the Census 2020.
So Forefront is funding 42 organizations that will be canvassing the state to encourage participation in the census. Now, a group that you've said will be working in the Bloomington Normal area is a Chicago-based group, Illinois Partners for Human Service. So tell us, who will be on the ground in Bloomington Normal, and what specifically will they be doing?
Certainly. There are a number of organizations within those 42 grantees that will be doing statewide work. Illinois Partners for Human Service is one of those groups. But there are a number of other groups. But these folks will be responsible for ensuring that those hard-to-count communities are well-educated and have access to resources so that they can self-report come next spring.
You referenced an online component to the census this year and social media being used in ways that, well, didn't exist at the time of the last census. So how will electronic media be used to help boost the count?
We are hearing that the Census Bureau will be working closely with Facebook and Twitter and Instagram to push out messages, important messages of how people can self-report. But we also know that Forefront's grantees will be working with social media to get a social media strategy out. And also there will be a digital strategy, national digital strategy, Get Out the Count training that will be available to all organizations that are interested in doing this work across the country.
Now, you've addressed some of the groups that have been undercounted in the past, but how much might be fueled by skepticism, mistrust about how their information is being used, because it seems that antitrust or a lack of faith in government is maybe higher than it's ever been?
Yes, that is a good point. There was a study done. There was some focus groups held by a national organization called NALEO, the National Association of Latino Elected Officials, that found that there is that growing sentiment across the country. And let's be frank, when you think about the rural communities and people living in rural communities, they aren't necessarily willing to share personal household data online. So that is very much a concern when you think about wanting to collect census data online and understanding that that's not the only way that you can self-report for the 2020 census, but it is an important, critical piece.
Online reporting did not exist in the 2010 census?
It did not, no. The only way, I believe, was the paper form. And now, ahead of the 2020 census, there will be three ways to report. There will still be the traditional paper format, but it won't be available to everyone. There will be, obviously, the online portion. And then people can also call in to the Census Bureau. And I believe that that availability will be within 12 languages.
And this is Sound Ideas. I'm Eric Stock with Anita Banerjee, director of the Democracy Institute, the nonprofit organization Forefront that has been working to address concerns about the 2020 census. And there has been talk in Bloomington Normal, the mayors here, Terry Renner and Chris Coos. They spoke at a recent U.S. Conference of Mayors where the census was discussed. And they've started discussions about setting up a task force to address the census locally. Now, they've since told us they're willing to wait and see what efforts are already working on this in the community and help supplement those efforts if useful. What kind of participation do you want or look for on the local level to assist in this effort?
Yes. So what are called local count committees are essential to getting out the count. And this is made up of local elected officials, community leaders, nonprofit leaders, leaders that are working with vulnerable populations, and they come together and they think about what is a strategy that best works for that specific community, because we know that what works in Greater Chicago doesn't necessarily work in Central Illinois, and what works in Central Illinois doesn't necessarily work in Southern Illinois. So it's really about utilizing the skills of the various community leaders within that specific community.
And Normal is home to Illinois State University, a school of 20-plus thousand students, a majority of which have a primary residence of Normal, and others who live elsewhere. Mayor Coos has said he's concerned. He wants to make sure that the population gets counted appropriately. You've alluded to the fact that college campuses sometimes have a challenge with that. How do you work to ensure that that population gets counted fully?
Well, I think this is where if there's a Department of Civic Education or Civic Engagement at the university.
And there certainly is.
This is a perfect issue for that department to get engaged in and to have community gatherings, to have a social media strategy, to be able to share this for information come, orientation or when people are back to school, to have a congressional community briefing with the elected official in that area, with state elected officials, anything that you can do, especially when you think about the get out the vote efforts that will be happening with the March primary. That's around the time that the census count will be going into full effect. And so really great way to incorporate GOTV and GOTC efforts.
Now, the census has been making headlines in recent weeks. President Trump had said that he wanted to put a citizenship question on the census to account for the undocumented immigrants who are living here. Now, he has since withdrawn that request after it failed in the courts, and now he said he wants to use other means to get that data. How would that have impacted your census outreach?
Well, we know that whether the question is on the form or not, that we have to double down and work harder, smarter, and collaboratively to ensure a fair and accurate count. As I mentioned earlier, those various reasons why it's so important to be counted, we have to ensure that communities feel safe, they feel protected, and they understand why they need to be self-protected and self-respond. So understanding all of those efforts, we are continuing to move forward. We now need to focus on get out the count efforts. The census count is less than a year away, so we have a lot of work ahead of us.
Now, had the president insisted on fighting the citizenship question, man, let's say another president tries in 10 years, had the administration provided assurances that the data would not be used in any way to track down and deport those who are undocumented. Could such an inquiry on a census questionnaire be satisfactory to Forefront?
Well, this is, I mean, we can't speak on behalf of the Census Bureau, right? We are working very complementary to their work. We understand that there are concerns for particular communities, knowing that that question would be on there. But we also understand that the Census Bureau is protected by Title 13 that ensures that people's personal household data is kept confidential for 72 years after each decennial census. So as we are out with the charge of getting and asking people to self-report and ensuring that people are counted, we also want to be mindful that the Census Bureau has this protection in place.
That was Anita Banerjee of the nonprofit group Forefront with GLT's Eric Stock. Governor J.B. Pritzker has budgeted $29 million for census outreach. He has said for each 1% of the population that's undercounted, the state would lose $1.2 billion over a decade.
Multi-course breakfasts are usually reserved for your weekends, but on Morning Edition, we serve up a full meal every day. So you get substance.
Without empathy, we would be just alone.
And something to savor, too.
Live now, love hard, and appreciate everything.
Get your fill of stories from around the world. Start your day with Morning Edition from NPR News.
I'm GLT Morning Edition host John Norton. Join me weekdays from 4 to 9 a.m. on GLT.
Support for GLT comes from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting's Community Service Grant and from a grant from the Illinois Arts Council Agency. These grants help fund Morning Edition, All Things Considered, and other programming on which you depend for news, information, and entertainment. Additional support comes from GLT contributing listeners. This is 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. Coming up, plants and enzymes, a report on genetic engineering. Several years ago, Illinois overhauled how it taught civics to high schoolers. A new measure would add the same requirement for middle school students. IPR's Peter Medlin has more.
Jim Vera teaches government at Oswego East High School. He often has his students, mostly sophomores, stand in all four corners of the classroom. The corners are marked agree, disagree, strongly agree, and strongly disagree. He starts small. Do we have a good sports program here? They all pick a corner. Then the debate escalates until eventually they're discussing topics like, is it okay to burn the American flag? This is one of the four mandatory components of the civics class. The others are government institutions, service learning, and simulations. The flag-burning conversation is part of the current and controversial issues, which I'm sure you could have guessed.
Like, I always tell our younger teachers that, you know, if you see something's going bad, don't be afraid of it, but, like, give a kid a voice, but, like, don't be afraid to challenge the kid. Okay, well, where is your information on that from?
Vera acknowledges that these conversations can be hard. For students, yes, but also their teachers, who don't want to be called into the principal's office because of a complaint from a parent that their kid is talking about burning flags in class. That's happened to Vera in the past, too.
Doing an activity like the Four Corners kind of allows a kid, that quiet kid that maybe has strong feeling on something, but doesn't necessarily want to speak out on it. At least in that way, they feel like they still have a voice.
Members of the first class affected by the 2015 high school measure are going to be seniors this year. And since many schools offer civics as a senior course, a lot of students across the state will be taking it for the first time soon. And that's just in time for all of them to turn 18 before the presidential election next year. Vera says for both high school and middle school civics, it's smart to keep things as local as possible, especially for those service learning projects. Vera's students have talked to village and school board members about installing lights at intersections and changing backpack rules at their own school.
I think the most important part of those projects is, like, the research and finding out who to go to. You know, I don't write a letter to the president when you want to get a stoplight put in.
After the high school civics mandate passed, regional mentor teachers, including Vera, went to Springfield for training with the News Literacy Project.
Information is the most basic ingredient of civics.
That's Peter Adams. He's the Senior Vice President of Education at the News Literacy Project, and he also is the one that helped train those teachers.
You know, it's daunting. I mean, we're all sort of grappling with the largest and most complex information landscape in human history, and that's incredibly daunting for the young people who are inheriting that landscape, but it's also daunting for educators who are trying to teach them about it.
For the project, it's not just about high school and middle school kids being able to identify what is and is not a credible source, although that is important, especially on social media. Adam says it's also about understanding why a post is in your feed at all.
Even though, you know, they may not have smartphones at those younger grades, by middle school, they certainly do.
John Silva is a news literacy and civics team leader for the project. He also taught civics for over a decade at Chicago Public Schools.
And it's at that age where they are much more curious about the world, but they're also at a developmental age where they're not able to quite so easily recognize when they're being manipulated by misinformation or propaganda or conspiracy theories.
So Adam says the organization wants to help students unlock the architecture of these social platforms to see if they can see who's behind a questionable post and if they can report them.
So for example, on Pinterest, you can report posts or pins as medical misinformation, which is a very specific, but I think very important possibility there, that there's a label for that.
Silva says once young students have the tools to maneuver the social media information minefield, then they can move forward into civil discourse. Jim Vera over at Oswego East agrees it's important to build confidence for kids as young as middle school in those arenas.
In a lot of ways, the younger kids are able to like handle those concepts better than things like memorizing the chain of command for the executive branch.
If signed by the governor, the plan for middle school civics would go into effect in the 2020-21 school year. I'm Peter Medlin.
Listen to NPR's 1A weekdays at 9 a.m. on GLT. You'll hear conversations about technology, politics, the arts, and the week's news. And there's always time for you to submit your questions using the 1A app, Twitter, Facebook, or even voicemail. Join host Joshua Johnson from 9 a.m. to 11 a.m. for 1A weekdays on GLT, Bloomington Normal's public media. A new study from the University of Illinois and Cornell shows plants genetically engineered to churn out useful enzymes grow well under field conditions, which is important for large-scale production. The researchers describe in the journal Nature Plants how they genetically modified tobacco plants to produce an enzyme used in biofuel production. U of I research scientist Justin McGrath is a co-lead author of the study. He speaks with Christine Herman of IPR about how this method could help lower the cost of making enzymes, vaccines, and other proteins for medical and industrial applications.
In this study, you all put the DNA coding for the proteins you're trying to create in the chloroplasts. Can you remind us what the chloroplast is and why it's significant that the DNA was placed there instead of in the nucleus?
All plants have chloroplasts, and these are where photosynthesis actually occurs, and it's what makes plants green. And one advantage of doing that is pollen doesn't have chloroplasts. It's in the other cells, but not in the pollen itself. And so the pollen won't have these genes, even if they were to flower. That pollen wouldn't let the genes out into other plants out in the wild. The other advantage is that each cell has one nucleus, whereas they can have thousands of chloroplasts. And so by incorporating the gene in the nucleus, you just have the one copy, and then to some degree, the plants will be limited by how much of the protein they make. Whereas if you put it in the chloroplast, you can have thousands and thousands of copies within one cell. And that would also have the benefit of plants just make a lot more of the protein when they have more copies of the gene.
So then the concern is if you're trying to use a plant and genetically engineer it to produce a lot of a certain type of protein that you want for commercial use, the concern would be that it might affect the yield. What did you find in this study?
Right. And so you'd think that these plants need proteins. And so if they're diverting resources and their native proteins to these foreign proteins, that it could have some cost. And so that's potentially true. But when we grow them in the field, we see no effect on yield at all. And so we grew them over 2 years, and those years were substantially different in the weather that they had. But despite that, we find that they yielded just as much as the plants without the transformation.
So what was the gene that you inserted into the chloroplast of these tobacco plants? What does it encode, and why did you choose it?
So the one we use is called cellulase, and this is a it produces a protein that can break down cellulose. Cellulose is the kind of the structure of all plants. And this is has a potential economic value in that people are trying to develop new ways to produce biofuels. And so typically that's done now by taking the sugary, easily digested parts of plants. So like you can think of the ear of the corn or like the seed of soybean. And the other parts of the plant aren't easily digestible. Like you can't eat the stems and the leaves. But there's actually a lot of energy in those. And so if you could break down those tissues, you can use those to produce biofuels. And cellulose is an enzyme that does exactly that. So it breaks down the cellulose in the plant. And it has that commercial value. This was kind of a proof of concept in general, though. And so that is commercially valuable. But you could do this with all sorts of proteins. So it wouldn't have to be just cellulase.
Is it correct that the method that you all developed can produce these proteins orders of magnitude cheaper than current production methods? Is that right?
That's what it looks like. So currently, you know, our estimates from this study are that it would cost about a dollar, you know, between, you know, 20 cents and $1 to produce a gram of the cellulase. Whereas current methods, depending on the type of method you're using, could cost from a couple hundred dollars to a couple thousand dollars.
And then could this method be easily extended to express other proteins? You mentioned vaccines. I know there's also interest in developing or creating large amounts of antibodies for medicinal treatments. Or does that remain to be seen?
Well, I think that that's definitely something that you could do with these. And to some degree, they're already doing that in tobacco. They're just not doing it with this precisely the same method we're using. And so that's the expectation, really, is that you could use these that way. Although for any of these, you're going to have to go through a series of tests and to see whether it actually works for the protein that you're trying to make and whether you can purify it.
That's U of I research scientist Justin McGrath speaking with Christine Herman. This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. Coming up, a Redbird basketball great shares her journey since college. It leads to a tribal court in Washington State. The Flanagan-Cornell Woodland football team last year didn't score a point until its sixth game of the season when it scored again 8 against Minunk. It went scoreless the rest of the year after barely having enough students to finish the year due to injuries and players quitting. This year, the school will play in Illinois' fledgling 8-man classification football after decades as a traditional 11-man squad. Illinois High School Association Executive Director Craig Anderson says 8-man football in Illinois got its start 2 years ago. He tells GLT's John Norton most schools choose this route for the same reason Flanagan-Cornell Woodland did. Numbers.
And we haven't, as an association, established some here, some hardline numbers. If you only have, you know, less than 20 freshmen to senior out for football, that's when you should start looking at 8-man as opposed to 11-man football. In general, I would say, you know, schools that are, you know, freshmen to senior falling under that 20 number of kids interested, that it may be a time to consider that option.
Is this somewhat more of a medium-term issue that school districts should be looking at as opposed to, oh, we only have X amount of kids out this fall and it's June, maybe we should do 8-man?
No, yeah, it's a tough thing to do. And with scheduling of football in particular, how difficult that is, it's something that they have to plan for. And, you know, whether they're doing interest surveys of students in anticipation of whether they're going to have the numbers needed to maintain an 11-man football team. But I think it's not something that in June, in my opinion, that you can all of a sudden say, oh, our numbers aren't where we wanted them to be, and so we're going to jump into 8-man football. I mean, they could try that, but I think it's going to be difficult for them to even find teams that will be interested in a schedule. And now they're dropping out of likely an 11-man football conference or schedule that they may have maintained that now – it puts a burden on their opponents,
right,
that were scheduled to now find an opponent, or now they have a bye in their schedule, and that's difficult.
So it is more of a medium term?
Yeah, I would say medium term, and you know, monitoring interest within their schools, and anticipating what the future numbers might look like for their teams in football.
Flanagan Cornell is one local school, at least in our area, that has decided to move in that direction. But it sounds like one of the issues is that the schools are fairly widespread across the state, and there's not a conference per se, at least yet. How do you plan on addressing that, and how much of an issue is that for these school districts to overcome?
Well, it's definitely a concern, you know, the interest being limited number of schools and, of course, being all across the state. The first set of schools kind of came from, I'm going to say, the north section of our state, northwest, and a little bit to the east. But then we had some from the Champaign area, and now, as you mentioned, Flanagan, Cornell. So it's starting to expand where travel isn't quite as far, but in addition to that, you know, our 11-man football teams are having trouble finding opponents, and so their non-conference schedule or some even that aren't able to land in a conference have found extreme travel.
Have school districts found that money-wise it's a wash going to 8-man football? Is there a financial burden difference going from 11 to 8-man football, not just traveling but anything else that might be associated with that?
Well, it's so early in its stages, I guess, at this point, that we haven't heard back from the membership that the move that they made has been a financial burden. You know, the ability to have football and to have all the tradition that goes along with having a football team in your community, there's a lot of benefits to that. You maintain homecoming, you maintain, you know, all the things that happen within a school in the start of the school year, in the fall. I think are important to schools. And as a result, you know, if they're taking on a little additional financial burden for maintaining football, even though it's 8-man football, I think they're finding the benefits of that for the camaraderie within their school and to have that sport continue to be provided.
Okay. Yeah. I'm thinking from a talented player point of view, moving from 11 to 8-man football, is there a concern from some parents or the athlete themselves in that they're not playing the game that they maybe can move on to the college level and play? Or is that not that big a concern?
You know, I don't think it's that big of a concern because the same skill set is necessary. You're still able to demonstrate your skills. You know, it's blocking and tackling and, you know, the skills that are involved in that along with the skill level to run and maneuver and pass and run. And so the concepts are very much the same. And so I don't think there's any concern, or at least we haven't heard any from athletes or families that, you know, that want to play at the next level saying, oh, you know, our school moved to 8-man and now I'm missing opportunities.
Craig Anderson, IHA Executive Director, our guest on GLT Sound Ideas. 8-man football is what we're talking about. When did 8-man football start in Illinois? Since you said these other states have had 8-man for a long time, this is relatively new to Illinois?
It is relatively new. I want to say maybe 2 years ago we had our first maybe three or four schools that decided they were going to try this. And so because there were so few, obviously they had to go out of state and find some out-of-state opponents. But then last year for the first time we had enough interest, about eight schools, and they came to our board and wanted to have a little postseason kind of a playoff because it wasn't in our bylaws, the opportunity to play beyond a nine-game schedule. They maintained a nine-game schedule but had, because of buys during the school year, were able to play a ninth game kind of championship. But they did get approved for this coming school year through our bylaws the opportunity for those member schools that are playing 8-man football to organize themselves to conduct, because they can do it on their own, I'm not sure what it's going to look like, but to organize some form of playoff that would have them extend beyond the 9-game regular season into maybe 11 or 12 games to complete some form of bracketed play and crown a champion of 8-man football. So I think the fact that they've now created this postseason opportunity and did it correctly through our bylaws, our membership passed it, that's been a way for them to encourage more schools to say, hey, there's an opportunity here, and if you excel, then you can, whether they're going to be a qualifier or they're going to allow all the schools, I really don't know what their bracket will look like in the postseason, but there is going to be a postseason opportunity now.
This year?
This school year, yeah, 2019.
Okay.
Yeah.
Are you hearing from other schools that in the next year or two that they want to join as well?
I think schools and districts where they're seeing a participation in football drop are keeping an eye on those schools and seeing the success and monitoring the interest that they have locally. And when schools are having a difficult time fielding 11-man teams, schools throughout the state are monitoring and looking at that. And the other thing that was passed this past school year is for us to, as an association, to move towards districting, which will be implemented in the fall of 21. Districting is the IHSA taking on the responsibility, basically, of forming conferences for our schools. We designate the teams at which they're going to play in the regular season. I anticipate that when we look towards districting, depending upon the success of eight-man football, that some of these cooperative agreements of two or three schools may now divide themselves up and say, we think we have enough interest that we'll maintain our own team as an eight-man football playing school as opposed to forming a cooperative for 11-man. So some of that movement's going to happen.
Okay. Is it possible that football could grow in Illinois because of eight-man football, where they maybe wouldn't have had, as you just outlined, a team before? They were co-oping with another one. We could have more teams and more players than before.
I definitely think
that's possible.
I think so, definitely. As we see the growth of this and the interest and the division of the co-ops, I think we could see more teams, some moving to eight-man because the cooperatives are going to dissolve themselves. And, you know, when one dissolves, they may form another in another area, or two schools that had 11-man together now dissolve their co-op to each have their own 8-man football team may absolutely create more teams in Illinois, but more 8-man than 11-man potentially.
Craig Anderson, IHSA Executive Director, our guest here on GLT Sound Ideas. We're talking about the increasing popularity of 8-man football in the state of Illinois. As we talked off the air, I was telling you I saw six-man football in North Dakota, and that's basically cutting the players in half that you need on the field. Cutting just three people from 11 doesn't seem like a whole lot, but it actually seems like it does make a difference.
Oh, it does make a difference. It's one less running back, one less lineman, and then one less additional receiver. So it does make a difference, especially a school with a small roster. In football, generally, you'll anticipate that you have one or two injuries or, a few throughout the season that are part of it. The schools that have jumped into it say that it's created a difference for them. And, they're able to field teams and successfully field teams with it doesn't seem like a whole lot, but in the big scheme of things, it is.
Illinois High School Association Executive Director Craig Anderson speaking with GLT's John Norton about the increased interest among Illinois small school districts to move from 11-man to 8-man football. The rules for 8-man are very similar to 11-man, and the field is narrower, 10 yards narrower. The Flanagan-Cornell-Woodland team this year will be one of 17 schools in the state playing 8-man football. Hearing some new shows on WGLT, and you can find a program schedule at WGLT.org. During the week, we're bringing you the best in contemporary music with NPR's World Cafe, weekday evenings at 7. On the weekend, listen for Hidden Brain and Freakonomics Radio and new music shows, including Sound Opinions and All Songs Considered. Those are just some of the new things we're offering. Check out the new schedule and let us know what you think by visiting WGLT.org. Jackie McCormick is a name Redbird basketball fans will remember. She hit the game-winning shot that clinched Illinois State's bid to the NCAA tournament in 2005. McCormick has come a long way from her Redbird days. She is now a victim assistant coordinator for the Tulalip Tribe Prosecutor's Office in Washington State, north of Seattle. WGLT's Eric Stock talks with McCormick about her days as a Redbird and her youth basketball program, Rise Above.
Rise Above was founded in 2015, and the reason why it was founded is I've always had the dream to give back to kids in any way that I could. I knew that I was paving a way for kids when I stepped foot on Illinois State campus, and I always told myself that I would give back in whatever capacity I could. So I teamed up with a pretty amazing business partner and figured out how to combine sports with prevention and education, and that's how Rise Above was born.
And there is a movie in production now based on your life called Rise Above. We understand it's scheduled to be released in 2021. Basketball Hall of Famer Lenny Wilkins is executive producer for the project, and I understand there are some other big names involved in this. Feel free to name drop. How did this come to be?
You know, it's been a pretty serendipitous thing, and Dennis Lee, who is a movie writer that lives in Los Angeles, actually approached my business partner and I and had said that he'd always wanted to do a movie about res ball. Well, when we had some dialogue going back and forth, he was interested in doing a film about my life story and asked if I would be open to that idea. And initially, as you may think, it was overwhelming. But I eventually said yes, because I think the struggles that I went through as a kid and growing up and leaving my reservation and going off to school and all of the things I had to overcome, if that can help even one kid, I'm all for it, because I'm about youth, because they're our future.
Well, there is so much to your life, and we're going to take a snapshot of it here during our visit. You were now with a flourish at Illinois State, sending the Redbirds into the NCAA tournament 14 years ago. But I know your time there wasn't always smooth. If you could take us back to a time when things weren't going so well at ISU and you were considering going back to Idaho.
You know, there's so many times that I struggled, especially in those first couple of years. And I think it was referenced in one of the articles. I was having a conversation with a friend, kind of just going through my experiences in college. And, you know, I was homesick. I had moved away when I was 15 years old. I was homesick. I was struggling academically. It was hard athletically. And I was like, you know what? This just is not for me. You know, this is not for me. I went in my coach's office, and at the time it was Coach Yop, and you know, I had quit to her 1,000 times, and she'd always bring me back and tell me reasons why I should stay. And finally, one day, she just said, you know what, Jackie, go ahead and quit. Go ahead and go back to the reservation and be another statistic about somebody who didn't make it but should have. That's all it took. And I don't feel like I ever quit again. At least I don't remember it. It's not a vivid memory, but I do have vivid memories of me quitting a lot until she said that. And I would say that my sophomore year was one of the hardest years of my life, because I had to redshirt, not by my choice, and I had surgery. So basketball was stripped away from me for the first time in my life. And I was 2,000 miles away from home. So it was a hard year for me.
But you're grateful for Coach perhaps using reverse psychology to keep you on track, right?
Absolutely. She made a lot of moves that at the moment I was really upset about and I didn't understand. One of those other moments is keeping me in school over break my sophomore year. I think that was one of the smartest things she ever did. Not giving me the full break like normally you get if you're injured and not traveling with the team.
And prior to your time at Illinois State, we were visiting with Jackie McCormick. You had a tumultuous few years in high school, which you had alluded to, after being named Idaho's Player of the Year as a freshman and sophomore, something I understand that your mother, Patty, had done when she played in the 1970s. So you led tiny Lapway, Idaho, to a state basketball championship. But according to a story that you told the media in Washington State, the spokesman, you would help prosecutors investigate a case involving a child's death. And you said that many of your peers had shunned you after that. Do you know why, and how did that affect you?
Well, you know, I can't speak for why other people reacted the way that they did. But, you know, I was shunned and I lost a lot of friendships over coming forward. And, you know, when I had spoke to people before, I was watching the news actually with my mom, and it was just something that was so heavy on my heart that I possibly knew who was involved. And, you know, it just struck me as something I couldn't keep inside. I'm not an emotional person normally, but I just broke down crying to my mom. And I knew when I did that, it was something that was heavy and needed to come forward. So going back, it's hard to look back at that and know why things happened the way that they did. But I was definitely shunned. But it created a platform for me to be able to move to Lake Oswego. So in a weird way, it kind of set me up for success.
So you moved to another school district, as you alluded to, had plenty of success there on the court, but it sounded like it was still a struggle for you. Can you talk about what you were dealing with at the time in acclimating to a new environment?
It was so hard. You know, in Lapway, the school makeup is, you know, over 80-some% Native American. And when I transferred to Lake Oswego, it was over 80% white. It was a very wealthy school, very wealthy community. And quite frankly, I just didn't fit in. And the only place that I kind of found my safe spot was when I was playing basketball, when I was in the gym. And that's where I felt comfortable.
And this is Sound Ideas. I'm Eric Stock with Jackie McCormick, formerly of the Illinois State basketball team back in 2005, and now a victims assistant coordinator in Washington State, and also president of Rise Above, a Native American youth basketball program. Jackie, what is the message that you are trying to convey to the youngsters under your care through the game of basketball?
You know, it's all about empowerment and creating resiliency in our kids. And through Rise Above, you know, we've tailored each of our clinics to meet the needs of each tribal community that we work with. And whether that's suicide prevention, diabetes education, healthy relationships, drug and alcohol prevention, whatever that message is, it's about empowerment, education, and resiliency, and how those things can get you to your next level. Whatever goal that is, those three things are going to be so key. And I just have really big dreams for Rise Above and be able to become a national program and impact many kids.
And Nike is commissioning you to help promote their N7 brand. If you could explain what that means a little bit and how that's helping Rise Above grow.
Absolutely. So I was blessed to get a call from Sam McCracken, who's the general manager of the Nike N7 brand, and they were featuring two athletes to support their efforts around this Hoop Fest, the really large 3-on-3 in Spokane, Washington. And being Nike, I think it's a great platform that, you know, just came in perfect timing with the film and kind of the momentum that we've had, and using that also as a way to give the message about, you know, impacting future generations. And, you know, one of the messages of the Nike N7 is until we all rise, or rise up, and it aligns with, you know, Rise Above, but it's until we all win. And I think that's a great message. And it ties right into the mission of Rise Above, where, you know, we're creating resiliency and for our future generations. So it's been a blessing. And I think it's going to definitely help with the message that we're trying to send through Rise Above.
And what did you study at Illinois State?
I studied sociology. I've always had an interest in people and why we do the things that we do. So I felt like sociology was a great fit for me. And lo and behold, I got my degree.
Well, congratulations for that. Did you ever imagine that as you were taking sociology classes back at Illinois State over a decade ago, that you would potentially be able to impact as many lives as you have through your nonprofit and through your work in the prosecutor's office in Washington State?
You know, I've been very blessed. And the short answer is no. But on the flip side of that is it's always been my dream to give back, and especially to kids. So I think opportunities are presented to a lot of people, and I've just been fortunate to be blessed with opportunities that I've taken advantage of with some pretty amazing people that I have in my corner. And I'm excited about the film, but I'm more excited about how it's going to impact kids in the long term, kind of the social movement that we're kind of focusing on with the film.
To take a step back, those of us in Bloomington Normal may not be as exposed to this as much as those who live in cultures where there is a stronger predominance of Native Americans. If you can talk a little bit about that to help people have a better understanding of some of the challenges and perhaps some of the divisions that may present itself while trying to integrate into a community that has a smaller Native American population, as you did when you transferred during high school.
No, I think one of the biggest things of growing up on a reservation or in a Native community is the sense of closeness. We have a very tight-knit community, and so you have a great support system in place. Not all, but most kids have a great support system in place where, you know, your parents are there, your aunts, your uncles, your cousins. You're constantly exposed to family and people that love and support you. And when you go to a basketball game, or when you go to graduation, or when you go to a birthday party, it's multiple people that you're related to that, you know, it's just a tight-knit community. So when I went to Lake Oswego, and there wasn't that factor, you know, I lived with my aunt and uncle, who were both Native, but it was a different feeling. And my aunt and uncle were both working parents of young boys. And my mom, I was raised by my grandparents, so she was home every day when I got home from school. And I just never realized the impact that my mom just being home when I got home from school had on me in a very positive way. It was almost a sense of comfort for me when I look back. I would say that was the biggest thing is, you know, we're very tight knit. And so, you know, I think when kids go off, when they leave the reservation and go to school, that's a struggle because there's so many people around that support you and look like you and talk like you talk. It's easy to miss that and want to go back.
WGLT's Eric Stock talking with former Illinois State Redbird basketball star Jackie McCormick. Thanks for choosing Sound Ideas on WGLT Normal, made possible with listener contributions at WGLT.org. Our website is also where you can find Sound Ideas interviews and stories with help today from Mary Cullen, Ryan Denham, John Norton, and Eric Stock. Thanks for stopping by. I'm Charlie Schlenker. You can subscribe to Sound Ideas on Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Stitcher, or NPR One. We want to know what you think of Sound Ideas. Comment on our Facebook page, We're WGLT-FM, or follow us on Twitter. We're all at WGLT News. This is 89.1 and WGLT.org, Bloomington Normal's public media.